First of all, we can begin our session. Thank you so much. After a long time, to be honest, that I was so busy. So sorry about that. Again, we start to have our Leech Club with dear Muhammad Taha. And as you're talking about the session, for sure we're gonna have a three, like a hierarchical session about the. We started from mythology, if I'm not wrong, that I just seen our messages and go through the Aristotle, and then we have a flashback to the literature, Latin literature, and then go to the epic heroic, and we go through to the contemporary one. Yes. I just distracted by Leila's the comment. It's fine. Totally. So today we started from the first session from our topics, and I started from the mythology to allegory. The floor is yours, Muhammad Taha. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. So let's begin with this lovely topic of, literature. So if we really want to describe this meeting, it's about the evolution of literature from the beginning, or you can say Western literature from the beginning of myth until the Victorian age. And as we said, we're gonna make it into three parts, and this first part is from myth to allegory. So it's from the ancient Greek until the time of the end of the Middle Ages. So as you've seen in this picture, you can see nine women, which is a photo of the nine muses, which is a myth that tells us the literary inspiration comes from. And this nine muses are the ones that brought upon the early literatures, for example, the narrative epic, the lyrical, the poetry, for example, the art of dancing, the art of music. And they, allegorically speaking, they symbolize all the arts. So our agenda begins with the Greek mythology. Then we'll dive into the epic, to the lyric, then the birth of drama, which is the time of tragedy and comedy, and into Plato's attack against the object of poetic artistic creation. And then we'll have multiple defenses, such as Aristotle's and Horace's defense of poetry, which talks about the structure of what is a poem, or you can say literature. So we're gonna have some discussions throughout time. It's gonna be philosophical, sometimes be about only literature, and sometimes it'd be only about the events happening in time, for example. So before we dive in into, history, I want to have some concepts in philosophy of literature explained. For example, we have the subject of fiction and non-fiction. As we know, this dichotomy of fiction and non-fiction means something, for example, true and something not true, or for example, lies or falsehood. So this subject changes throughout time. For example, the Greeks had different conception of this concept, and the Romans and also the people living in the Middle Ages had different conception of this concepts. For example, we have the prose and verse. At the time of ancient Greek and ancient Rome, you can say that prose was the main device to write about the rhetoric, about the philosophy, history. So the subject of prose was non-fictional, as you can say the logos, which means logic. And we have the verse, which is the subject of all literary creations, for example, the narrative poetry, the lyric poetry, or the dramatic one. There are some certain changes throughout time about prose and verse. For example, as we said in the ancient time, we had prose for non-fiction and verse for example fiction. But this dichotomy changes throughout time. For example, in the medieval ages, at the end, we have the first prose romances. And also we can say that we have literature that is written from with the form of prose. So we have another conception. It's called author, reader, and the text. It's a modern terms in philosophy of literature. What it distincts the elements of, for example, interpretation. So we have the author as the one who creates, is as we have it inside the classical thoughts. The author is a creator which imitates reality. And for example, the reader is someone that in the classical literature, reader has different conception. For example, it equals audience, because at the time of the classical literature, we can see that all kinds of literature was performed in a way. For example, the epic was performed as a rhapsode, and the lyric poetry was performed with a lyre, and it was always in a stage. And as you know, dramatic poetry is like drama, so it's always linked to theater. And then we have the object of textuality, or you know, the text, which also has been differently conceived throughout time. So, for example, at the time of the Middle Ages, we can see that all texts are inherently intertextual. For example, we have some certain canons, for example, the Arthurian legend. And we have all kind of texts kind of linking towards it, and does adapt some sort of certain elements from that certain text. For example, the Arthurian legend created the romance, and for example, the knight quest genre, for example. So this conception does changes, and we have some certain view about these three concepts, for example, in literary theory. And as for example, when we bring the author as the main meaning-centered explanation, for example, we have romantic poetry, which is author-centric, or we can say intentional or expressive. Then we have reader, as you heard inside of literary theory, reader-oriented criticism. And both the reader and text come from one single post-structural thought. For example, we have the death of the author, the birth of the reader, and it just divides in two branches, the reader-oriented, and for example, in the text, we have symbols of formalism and structuralism. Then we have this certain genres, or you can say forms, because our object of discussion is forms. So we have three forms in ancient Greek: the dramatic poetry, the lyric poetry, and the narrative poetry. And for our modern perspective, you can say that drama is now, for example, the theater. Lyric is the original poetry that we know today. And narration comes to be the novel of the short story in our contemporary time. So we have these forms. For example, we are having a, wait, no. Yeah, we're having a discussion of form and content. For example, we have the form as the structure of the literature. For example, if it's written in a dactylic hexameter, it's a epic, for example. Or for example, we have the ode, or the lyric, or for example, the elegy as personal kind of poetry or literary writing. But all of these forms were written in verse, for example. And this verse does gives us a sense of this fictionality. So let's dive in into another subject, which is also important into inside Plato's dialogues, and is literature does gives us three kinds of values: an ethical value, a cognitive value, and aesthetic value. An ethical value would mean that something, the content of the literature, or for example, story, is maybe moral, immoral, or for example, immoral. And for the cognitive value, it is the question of truth, or you know, the question of fictionality and non-fictionality, because we have the subject of some kind of facts inside a fictional writings. For example, we know Sherlock Holmes is a British detective living in London, and this is some kind of facts existing inside a fictional writing, but it does gives us a paradoxical understanding of literature. And this is the subject has different answer throughout time. And we have the aesthetic value. The aesthetic value is have different kind of for example, divisions. As the first division, it does literally means something is beautiful. But as the secondary meaning, or you can say the modern meaning, is it means that something is inherently an artifact of art. So it does show some certain elements that is distinct from its truthfulness, or you know, moralityness. Then let's begin with our original subject, the myth. As we know, the myth, it has a meaning. The myth does continually denotes as something as of a story. So a myth is a story, or a tale, for example, a legend, a fable. We have different connotations for this word, but as we know, the myth is an object of story. So at the time of Greek, before the writings of Homer, Iliad, and the Odyssey, there were different folk, what's it called? Folk understandings of the gods, for example, of the heroes. It was orally transmitted as rhapsodes, as some kinds of tellings between different people. But at the time of Hesiod and Homer, two of the greatest poets at the time of the classical age, or you can say the antiquity age before the classical age, and these two written epic poems, you can say, and these epic poems does have what kind of some kind of understanding of the culture or identity of the Greek people. So the Greeks derived their identity from the works of Homer and Hesiod. Theogony by Hesiod is inherently this. It just tells the story of all of the world beginning from chaos, the void, and it gives birth to earth, the heavens, desire, and all kinds of primordial beings. And these primordial beings give birth to the Titans, and these Titans give birth ultimately to the Olympians. And we have different wars in this stages, for example, Titanomachia, Gigantomachia, two wars between the Olympians and the Titans, then Olympians and the Giants. And there is different sections of how the world was created. This whole story is summarized in the book called Mythology by Edith Hamilton. I think it's the first part. You can read it there if you don't want to read Theogony. And we have Homer, the greatest classical poet or Greek poet, for example. And these two works, the Iliad and the Odyssey, does gives us a real conception of what literature could be, for example. These two works always been Part of the program of the Greeks. And for example, we have the Trojan War that's happens inside the Iliad. And the Greeks do trace the ancestry from the people who are returning to the Greek after the Trojan War. So we can say that the Greek derive their ancestry from Odysseus and the ones that came back to, for example, Greek and make create Greek, because at that time there was no Greece. And thus gives us a lot of structures for the future artistic creations. But as we know, at that time there wasn't a clear form and structure for literature. There were always a sense of chaos inside these works. But these works were kind of intertextual in their form. For example, you can see that many of the works after the epic, you know, this is the first epics, and as we said, it was always performed as a rhapsode between people, and these rhapsodes were originally ultimately written down as, you know, the Iliad and the Odyssey. Then we have the time period after the birth of the epic. We call it the birth of the lyric. And we have multiple artists, or, you know, authors, which, or you can say poets, that created this genre. For example, Archilochus of Paros was the first personal poet. He was the first lyric poet also. And he wrote in with the lyre, for example, because the lyric is derived from the lyre. Sappho of Lesbos was the first woman poet, and she does she's shown as one of the patrons and the forerunners of the lyric poetry, and we have multiple other poems about her after this time. And then we have Pindar, and he's the one who created the ode. Then we have the Old Ode by Pindar, and we have the Roman Ode, which is derived from the Pindarian lyric, which we call it the Horatian ode. Then we have the time period of the birth of drama. Drama does begin with a structure of a monologue. There is one actor, and he speaks, the only one speaks in a stage. But the evolution that makes drama so important now in classical literature was becoming a dialogue. And how did it become a dialogue? Is by adding the second actor. And the one who added the second actor was Aeschylus. He's the father of tragedy, and his works are also inherently intertextual, because as we've seen, his first tragedy called Agamemnon is about the king that went to Troy fighting the Trojans. And it is about after him, it's about him going back home to Greece. Then he gets killed by his wife Clementra, because before going to the Troy, you know, beginning the Trojan War, he sacrificed his own daughter. And this act made his wife kill him when he comes back after the war. And then we have the libation bearers. It is the continuation of that story where Orestes, I think, yeah, Orestes comes back, and he sees that his mother killed his father. Then he also, with his sister Electra, kills their mother and her lover. So these kind of actions, as we've seen in our modern understanding, it's highly unethical. Why? Because we can see in these works, you can see that a father kills his own daughter. Then a wife kills her own husband. Then we see children killing their own parents. So it's entirely immoral. And this is one of the subjects, or you can say one of the attacks that Plato has argued about inside this subject of tragedy. And the end, we have the Eumenides and tease about the punishment of Orestes. And then we have the other tragedian we call Sophocles. He came after him and he added the third actor, which created a sense of tension and conflict inside tragedy. So we have the most famous work called Oedipus Rex, and it is a work which shows this tragic flaw people can have, especially people who are noble, such as Oedipus. Then we have the other stories which also do connect with other works such as Antigone and Electra and Ajax. Ajax being a hero inside the Trojan War, Electra being the daughter of Agamemnon, and Antigone, I think, was the daughter of Oedipus. Then we have the last one, the famous three tragedians, Euripides, and he has other works such as the Medea, the Bacchae, which is also shows what the tragedy is, or you can say drama is derived from. The tragedy and the drama is derived from Dionysian, what are called festivals. It was performed, people came to be, and it was all about the glorification of the gods. Then we have all other different works, and we are not entitled to speak about them because we want to go into the Middle Ages. We have the sense of comedy, because after tragedy came to be and the tragedians complicated the drama, when then we have a lot of control over the actors and the tensions and the plot, we had something called comedy. And comedy has a sense of difference with, for example, tragedy, where comedy does have people that are, you can say, actors or characters that function as people lower than us, which are the lower social group. And we have the tragedy, which is about nobility, about people that are greater than us, people that can be known as, tragic heroes. Aristophanes is one of the first satirists, and he tried to, for example, try to attack politicians, for example, even Socrates at that time period. Socrates, no, not Socrates. Socrates haven't came into this period. Some politicians inside Athens, they use comedy. It's like our modern word of dissing. We have dissing inside rapping, for example, at the time of the modern music. At that time, we had the act of satire. Then there we had some early prose and philosophers which wrote in prose, for example, such as Herodotus, which is the father of history, and Thucydides, which is also a historian, I think. Yeah, and we had the pre-Socratic philosophers, which were kind of people that changed our cognition of reality. Then we begin with our defense, not defense, attack about poetry. Plato was kind of a person that was already had a sense of poetic spirit. He was already trained to be a poet before becoming a philosopher. That's why he had a kind of a oscillation about his usage or the functions of poetry. This man had two kind of concepts about poetry. One is related to the theory of forms, the other one is about the theory of imitation. Yeah, I know. Plato was against literature, but he has some certain what again, philosophy about it. It's not he wasn't entirely against literature. He had some sense of oscillation between it. We're gonna talk about it. So we have the Republic, which is a kind of a utopian work, for example. It is a place where people live alongside each other, and there is a sense of rules, and there is a sense of democracy. And this in this republic, he believed that poets don't have any place in it. Why? So he believed art, or you can say all kind of artistic creations, are a form of mimesis, or you can say imitation. So what does he mean by imitation? He had a philosophy called the allegory of caves and the world of forms. So he means there is a concept called the idea or the true form, which exists in the ideal world, the world of idea. And then we have the physical object, which is a copy of the form. For example, we have some certain conception of a chair. For example, it is an idea of a chair. Then we have the physical object, which is an imitation of that form that I'm having in my mind. So this physical object is the copy of this form. Then we have the artistic representation, which is the copy of the copy, which is thrice removed from reality. What does he mean by that? He means, for example, a painter does paint a picture of a chair. So this picture of a chair isn't the chair itself. It is not even the physical thing. It is something very removed from this reality, from this idea of a chair. So this sense of understanding is kind of structuralist, for example. We can see that language, as Saussure says, is arbitrary, then it becomes conventional, and at the end it is differential. And this is what does he mean by that. The true form being the signification of the thing, and the word as we talk about it is the signifier. Then we have a certain distinction between the form and content, because we have the philosophy of Plato, then we have our philosophy of literature. We have the philosophy of Plato, which says the form of the idea, and we have the content with each, which is the material. And in this sense, the form or idea is higher than the material. But in another sense, which Plato says, the content is the idea, for example, what we derive from the poem, for example, or literary writing. And we have the form, which is the structure and the appearance of the said poem, for example. So here he says that the idea or the thing that people learn from, for example, a literary writing is more important than this appearances which creates the structure of a poem. For example, the meter, the rhythm, the rhyme, the alliteration, all of these elements are secondary to the philosophical or truthful content. So what does he ultimately mean? He means that fiction is not true, or it is a sense of lies, and it is ultimately used to deceive the populace. So that's why he disagree with the poets being inside his republic, because poetry does deal with emotion. It arises these emotions and drives irrationality. He says that we have three types of conceptions inside of us. There is the appetite, there is the spirit, and there is the reason. And poetry does only meet the desires of the appetite, and it does corrupt the spirit, the soul, and it makes us irrational. So why he does mean it like this? As we said, inside Hesiod and Homer, and even inside the tragedy, we can see a lot of immoral things. For example, father killing his own son, a son killing his own father. For example, the time of Oedipus Rex, which he ultimately kills his father. And we have the in mythology where Zeus kills Cronos, and Cronos killed his own father Uranus. This sense of ethics wasn't entirely accepted inside the Republic, or you can say this utopian more that Plato imagined. So he said that this Republic is built upon virtue and reason, and poetry does corrupt you, the youth. If we want to have a certain example, we don't let our kids at the time of being adolescents, at the time of being a kid, we don't let them watch, for example, 18 plus movies, because it does corrupt their understanding of, for example, ethics. And this is the reason that Plato does dismiss poetry. But that's why I said he has an isolation between, you know, the object of poets, because he also respects Homer and Hesiod. He also has a sense of understanding towards, you know, poetry. He also wrote in verse in his own works. So even though that we call him a philosopher, he was a philosopher, philosopher poet. And this is what he does mean by wanting poets to become more philosophical oriented. The things that he attacks is the object of this object of emotion. For example, he says emotion makes us do irrational things, and this form doesn't work inside our republic, because if you bring someone that able to deceive the populace inside the governance, then our republic wouldn't work. It would be inherently dysfunctional. And this is what he tries to do. He also does say that, for example, there is some certain elements that he also mentioned. For example, the nature of literature. We said that literature is inherently mimetic. It imitates appearances, not truth. This is one of the subjects of debate, that we only imitate the appearances of things. Then this cognitive value means that we are this people, these poets, lack real knowledge about what are they are depicting. So, for example, he depicts a chair, but he doesn't know what is a chair or what is the function of a chair. Only the craftsman and the philosopher knows what is the function of a chair. And this is what he says about the object of poetry. It corrupts the soul. It is inherently seductive. It is dangerous unless it's controlled. This is the subject that he oscillates between. If poetry is able to work in its educational function, it would be good for society. But if not, if it's only for, for example, only to please and pleasure, it's not effective in our republic. So the philosopher's role is to guide art towards truth and virtue. He says that the philosopher should help the poet find his own way. And he ultimately wants the poets to be one that unites the inspirational feature of poetry and the rational knowledge. Then we have different treatises side history. As you say, at the end of, for example, Plato's discussion, he said if someone can use verse and poetry to write a defense, an eloquent defense, that proves to me that poetry is good, then I'm all ears. And people do that. For example, the first one is Poetics by Aristotle. And he's the student of Plato himself, and he wrote Poetics, or what we call the study of poetic writing, an object. So there is a certain genre called defenses of poetry. We have Ars Poetica after Aristotle. We have On the Sublime by Longinus. We have the defense of poesy by Philip Sidney inside the Renaissance, and we have the defense of poetry by Shelley in the New Classical Age. No, in the Romantic Age. My bad. So we have Aristotle as the main literary thinker. He was a philosopher, and he was a person that had a positive opinion about poetry compared to his teacher, Plato. So he does create a sort of distinction between the poet, the philosopher, and the historian. All of these work with form. They work with verse and prose. They write literature. Well, but what does makes them distinct? The poet, as Aristotle says, is better suited to discuss, for example, historical events, because he presents them in a better artistic sense. And he can be better than the philosopher when he talks about the abstract ideas. For example, in a literature, we have two kinds of themes. There is the topical or a particular theme inside of a story. Then we have the universal themes, which deals with philosophy, for example. And for example, we have Oedipus Rex, and the universal theme is determinism. We cannot fight fate, for example. What it sits upon us, we're not able to, fight. Then he says that the poet, this is the first articulation of the author. The poet is like a craftsman. He is not inherently, for example, influenced by the muses, because Plato says that the authors or the poet is someone that is influenced by the muses with inspiration, divine inspiration, and he is having this subject of madness. So poets are mad. But Aristotle says that no, the poet is an artist. He uses technique, craft to create a form that puts some sort of content inside of it. And there is a sense of unity between all of the fragments of this whole artifact. Then we have some certain recognition. Aristotle does says art is inherently mimetic, like Plato, but is mimetic as it represents the human actions. Plato says that imitation is a form of imitating reality, or the things that is thrice removed from reality. But Plato has a certain distinction, because this is the first structuring of literature. We didn't have any structure of literature. This is why Plato attacked poetry, because it didn't have any sense of order. It was always chaos. There is no sense of rules. There is no sense of articulation. There is no sense of unity. But in this time period, Aristotle creates this sense of rules. So it is said that imitation is natural. All men imitate reality. This is how we learn everything from childhood. And this is inherently something common. But the poet, as being a craftsman, does usually do it better. And the Poetics, the work by Aristotle, it's divided in this different section. He begins by defining what is poetry. He says what is the nature and function of tragedy, elements of tragedy, structure of plot, the style and diction, epic versus tragedy. But this subject is only part of the book one of the Poetic series. The book two, which talks about comedy, is already lost in time. You can say it's already destroyed. And we don't have the subject of comedy inside Poetics. That's why when you read Poetics, it's always talking about tragedy. So what kind of mimesis or what kind of imitation do we have inside poetry? We have the objects being imitated. For example, people. They can be noble or, for example, being common. The means of imitation are different. For example, the use of language. For example, how we said language means prose and verse. The rhythm, melody, as music being part of the performance. And we have the mode, the mood, or you can say the manner of representation, which can be narrative or it is a sense of action, like performed in a stage like theater. So this kind of difference between mimesis creates this genres, or you can say forms of poetry. The epic, being a narrative verse, uses the language of prose and uses the language of verse, and being a narrative sense of distinction. The tragedy being acted upon, the comedy has the element of ridicule, and the lyric being rhythmic, musical, and sense of personality, not personality, personal as being. So in poetic sense, or you can say Aristotelian sense, when he says tragedy is an imitation of an action which is serious, he means that plot, what happens, it means more than what the character, let me rephrase it. It means that the happenings inside of a story are more important than the characters, the people these events happen to. So the plot is important. The imitation is about action. It's not about the people. So when he creates this distinction that says that it should be serious and complete, he means that it has a certain taste, because the comedy is a form of being not serious, but the tragedy is serious, the same as the epic. Epic has this same element with the tragedy, being a serious action. Being complete means that the action starts from the beginning. There is a beginning, a middle, and there is an end. The beginning is where the causes and effects, the beginnings of the conflict, the tensions, all the way are beginning inside this act one. Because when we say there is a beginning, it means that the actions shouldn't be connected to an action before this act one, for example. Then, for example, we can say that there was 1,000 years ago, someone killed another person, and now we are talking about what happened to that person. It should not be like this. It should be connected to a story that is narratively written. So when we say it having a certain magnitude, we mean that the style and the no, not the, it doesn't mean like this. It means that there is a sense of unity between, the action, the time, and the place. The time means that all kinds of actions happening in a play shouldn't it always happen inside a 24 hours period. It shouldn't happen as something in few months because the action only happens in a short moment. And we have the place. You cannot say that the action is happening inside, Greece, and then the next scene you can see it inside Rome. It shouldn't be like this. There's a sense of unity. Then we have them certain embellishment with each kind of artistic ornament, which means the melody, for example, music, the rhythm, the diction, the all kinds of artistic shaping or the stylistic choices that the author choose. And this creates the sense of poetry. So we can say there is a contrast between the epic and the drama. And this contrast is between showing and telling. The drama shows you the action, but the epic tells you the action, what happens. And there is a sense of clarification. The catharsis happens, and you have a sense of pity and fear, and there is a sense of purging these emotions. There is a need for an action that makes you purge this pity and fear at the end of the poem, for example. Tragedy does have these certain elements, as Aristotle says, the plot, which we call the mythos, character, thought, diction, melody, and spectacle. These all creating a theater. And there are forms that define it. Without these, we don't criticize something as being a tragedy. Then there is. That doesn't work. There is a certain difference between what tragedy is. There is two types of plots, a simple plot and a complex plot. In a complex plot, we have these four stages, which are important that we achieve catharsis. There is a reversal of fortune. For example, Oedipus being a king, then becoming an outcast after having this sense of recognition that, for example, he realized he killed his father. When he realized that, he had this sense of change of identity. He fell from being a king to an outcast. Then we have Hemartia. Hemartia means error. So in this kind of works, we say that we don't have anything perfect in the world, especially people. However, they are noble, epic, powerful. They have a sense of a tragic flaw. And this tragic flaw does make you commit an error inside your life. And this error begins this reversal, or you can say the change in fortune. At the end, when there is all the causes being let out, there is the effect at the end of the tragedy, and that's suffering. Oedipus suffers at the end of the work. He blinds himself with a knife because he has this sense of being blinded before Now after he blinded himself, it becomes paradoxical, and now he sees better. And this is sense of truth and lies, or you can say truth and fiction about understanding. Yeah, this is a pity. So we have this.
I'm
Yeah.
sorry, I don't want to interrupt you, Mama Taha, but can you please let me know how much time you need?
Well, let me see what time it is. I cannot see what time it is right now.
It's okay if you have just like 5 minutes, it's fine, but I want to know that if.
Oh, yeah. So I think there is a lot of things left because I'm still in ancient, but I'll skip all of them because we have this sense. Yeah.
No, I don't want you to escape, to be
To be honest, yes, this
honest.
is the problem of time because we have a
We
lot of things
can
to do.
go through it for the we can go through it for the next session, but in a general, do you want to have like a because you have for sure like 3 or 4 session again. It's totally fine, but because you are out of time, you can just generally talking about what we're gonna talk and also about the next session. Is it okay?
Yes, okay. So we'll just have a certain, summarizing for what we're going to talk about in the next sessions. We have these parts about, the Hellenistic period, some the parts about the time of Alexander, the early Roman poets. Then we're gonna start with the Augustan age, speak about Virgil and Ovid, start with the acts of Decorum, classical, our understanding of Horace, which also does give us a sense of what is new classic at the 18th century. And this is a map of, can say, the Roman Empire, which it is as the last of our subject of classical, because at that time we have Britannia. Then we'll start the Middle Ages, and but if we don't have time, we can put it, next
Yeah, for
session.
sure, because I don't want to skip them, to be honest. I want to continue it for sure for the next session, to be honest. By the way, till now, thank you so much. It was really fantastic. And also thank you to the other our audience and our friends for sure. I want to switch to Persian to talk a little bit about something. دوستان حالا عزیزانی که اینجا هستن قطعا بچه هستن که همچنان ما رو فالو میکنن و دنبال دارن بسیار بس افتخار قطعا برای همه ماها و ولی خب یک انتقادی حالا شکل گرفت داخل گروه و کانال من دوست داشتم اینجا یک کوچولو بهش اشاره کنم از بابت اینی که لیچ کلاب عملا مال شماست و هیچ چیزی نداره همونجوری که میبینید قطعا میایم اینجا لذت میبریم هممون نشسته گفتگو هم هیچ کدوممون هم پرفکت نیستیم دوست دارم مثل محمد تاهای عزیز خودتون بیان پیشنهاد بدین اینجا یاد میگیریم همه کنار هم استفاده میکنیم و قطعا خود لیش کلاب میتونه یک تریبونی باشه برای شماها چه اگر دوست دارید مطالبی رو اصلا با دوستاتون به اشتراک بذارید چه یک تمرینی باشه برای ارائه های کلاسیتون یعنی که اصلا ببینید جوان شخصی ادبی به چه شکله که ما قطعا خوشحال میشیم و استقبال میکنیم ولی خب من یه کوچولو دوست دارم که حداقل توی این مسیری که داریم پیش میریم قطعا همطور که میدونید من اینجا الان 2 ساعت و نیم باهاتون اختلاف تایم دارم مسائلی که خب دغدغه هایی که اینجا هست قطعا با ایران متفاوته و تمام اینها اما همچنان داریم لیست لترچلن رو سرپا نگه میداریم کمک حال باشید یعنی من احساس میکنم بعضی از دوستان خیلی ریزبینانه دارن نگاه میکنن که یک عیب و ایرادی پیدا بشه و یک تارگت بزنن من خیلی دوست دارم که بیاین صحبت کنیم انتقادانه قطعا هممون توی حوزه ادبیاتیم دوست داریم که نقد بشیم صحبت کنیم با پروف ولی خب فکر میکنم راه و روش قشنگتری هم براش هست. به هر حال نمیخوام وقتتون رو بیشتر بگیرم. مرسی که تا اینجا همراهمون بودید. قطعا قراره طی چند هفته اخیر همراه محمد طاهای عزیز باشیم و مطالب جذابش. امیدوارم که استفاده کنید. پیشنهادی، سخنی، انتقادی، هرچی بود حتما بهم بگید. و مرسی از همگی. ممنونم محمد طاها جان. خسته نباشید.
It was my honor.
It was our pleasure
Hola,
for sure,
Yara.
and honor is all mine.
Yeah. So,
thank you,
goodbye,
Mohammed.
everyone. See you
Thank
all
you,
next week.
see you all for sure. Thank you, bye bye, have a good night.